The parties were not talking to each other. In fact, they had restraining orders in place, were nowhere near each other's position in the negotiation. And by the time I got involved, we only had one day to get a solution. Well, we got it done. I'll show you how. Welcome to the Pro Se Divorce Podcast, where you can learn how to turn mediocre mediations into major successes. My name is Tom Davis, and I'm a certified professional divorce mediator in Denver, Colorado. I've helped thousands of clients over the past two decades reach success rates and outcomes that are significantly higher than what is typical. In each episode, I will share valuable insights, practical skills, and tools you can utilize right away to improve your mediation outcomes. And I'll serve as your guide through the potentially confusing process of divorce. Better days are coming, starting now. So, big surprise, we used shuttle mediation. So, but what is it and how do you utilize it and when do you utilize it? So let's start by first defining it. Shuttle mediation is the process of using separate rooms or separate breakout rooms if you're doing a virtual mediation. There's no direct contact between the participants, the parties. The mediator carries the negotiation back and forth. Now, the mediator is not a messenger. The mediator will leave off, you know, negative aspects of the communication and deliver the positives. So, for example, it's quite common for me to hear, well, the other person's crazy if they think I'm going to just do whatever they want, but I'd be willing to do this if it means getting this done and everything like that. And they'll say some other, you know, venting type stuff. And then when I go to the other room, I say, yeah, they're agreeable to try this with you. And I usually get a response back. Really? They said that? And that's basically the truth. So yes. So we basically leave off the negatives because there's no point in conveying those things. And we stick to the essence of the agreement that will move it forward. And so in so doing, we use our knowledge about the both parties' positions, their interests, their concerns, when we discuss options with both sides. So we're not just, like I said, messengers going back and conveying offers back and forth. So you want to tap into what the mediator is, how they're structuring and proposing proposals and the communication back and forth, because they're utilizing this knowledge. And you can tap into that to narrow the gap between, you know, you and the other party. There can be some issues with shuttle mediation. You know, if the mediator forms a bias or the mediator does not accurately convey information effectively, that can create some issues, miscommunications, you know, and things like that. And it may be hard to detect since you don't know what the mediator is saying or what the mediator is hearing when with the other party. However, this process can convey the benefits of mediation to parties who cannot otherwise interact, and therefore is a very powerful feature of mediation and can produce solutions when there is no other option. At the end of the shuttle mediation process, if there is an agreement reached, the mediator may have both parties commit their agreement by signing a summary agreement where the basic points of the agreement are listed, and then follow that up with a more detailed written agreement called a Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, or the court documents filled in if the mediator is serving as a scrivener or the mediator is also an attorney. So that's basically what shuttle mediation is. How do you utilize it? There's two primary settings for shuttle mediation. One is in person and the other is virtual, you know, video conference or teleconference. And so in-person meetings would be two separate physical rooms and the mediator goes back and forth. And then obviously in like a video conference, you and the other party would be in separate breakout rooms and the mediator would leave your session, join the other session, and all that. Now all of mediation is typically done real time with both parties present, but in different locations. And so that is, you know, that way the mediator can go back and forth as they need to clarify information and you're available. And so that there's a couple of, you know, considerations or expectations to have with this process that can be surprising if it's your first time. And so you want to, I'll go through some of those things here now to help you with what to expect. The One of the most frustrating things about it is that you're paying for the whole time, even when the mediator is with the other party. And so, you know, the mediator may be over at talking to the other side for longer or shorter periods of time, or with you longer or shorter periods of time. And so there can be this reductive thinking that I'm paying for the time. I want to have more face time with the mediator, or I want the mediator to spend exactly as much time with me as they do with the other party. And if the mediator spends more time with the other party, there could be a perception that the other party is getting more value because you're paying for the mediator to talk with the other person more. And so one of the expectations I would have for you is, instead of looking at it like you're getting value when the mediator's talking to you, look at it as the mediator is going to spend their time where it's most needed. And so if they spend most of their time in the other room, it's because that may be where more time is needed. So as an example, I have cases where I sit down with a party and one side basically is pretty realistic in their expectations. And they are not emotionally activated as much. And so they're pretty much, you know, dialed into a good place. And then that conversation happens relatively quickly. And then I go to the other side and they're dealing with a variety of issues. Either they're not emotionally receptive, they're activated, they are still in some type of denial or bargaining about the whole situation, not really present in the terms of the negotiation. They're angry, they're bitter. You know, there's stuff going on, or they're misunderstanding the process. And so I end up spending more time with that person to help educate them and help, you know, get to, you know, the real essence of what we're here to talk about. And that can take some extra time. And it may be really, you know, difficult for the other side who's sitting there waiting for me when I thought I was going to be gone for 20 minutes and I come back 40 minutes later. You know, that can be a little nerve-wracking sometimes. So if that happens, you can just confirm what's going on with the mediator, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the other person's getting more value. It just means that's where more time is needed typically to move the whole conversation forward. So in that example, the mediator is working very hard for you because this is probably, you know, indicative of conversations that you were not able to have with the other party because of similar reasons. And so, you know, there's going to be waiting time. And so just be aware of that. And for virtual mediations, the added dynamic of you being, you know, possibly on your own at home, one of the things that you should have as a real expectation is that the mediations are private and confidential. So just because you might be able to have someone sitting just outside of camera or in the same room coaching or listening, that is strictly prohibited. These mediations are, you know, talking about information that is private to the parties. And so if I come back from talking to the other party and I'm conveying some income information or some other information as is necessary to have the conversation, the party whose information I'm sharing has an expectation of that information not being shared with any other family members of yours or other significant relationships or others who are sitting in earshot who have no business hearing that information. So it is strictly prohibited from having anyone sitting outside of the camera or in the room if you're on a teleconference call. And many times I will just at random have the person pick up their laptop and pan it around the room real quick and just to confirm no one else is there. And so just remember that's the expectation. It can be actually pretty devastating if we get, you know, 2 hours into a 3-hour mediation and then we find out someone's been listening in the whole time and has heard information that's confidential. That could actually end an entire mediation. And let's say it was going successfully and we were actually going to get somewhere. That'd be a real shame. So that is strictly prohibited. So a couple of things to get a handle on up front of any shuttle mediation. So if you're in, whether you're in virtual or in person, you want to confirm which rooms you're in. So if there is a in person, you know, the mediator should have offices at their facility where they can put you each in separate conference rooms or offices, and you want to confirm where the other party's at so you can avoid walking by it. Usually there's several ways to get to the kitchen and or restroom so that you can go that route instead of walking by, you know, the glass windows on the conference room and the other party sees you and now they get activated or you get activated. And I've seen that happen. So you really want to understand where they are so you can avoid them, particularly if there's any restraining order restrictions in effect at the time, but also just to avoid doing it because it's really disruptive when we're in the middle of talking and the other party, you know, sashays by the window and now we're talking about that now. So we want to understand where everybody's at. You want to understand the location of the kitchen in case you need to get something to drink, the bathrooms in case you need to use them. If you're in person, obviously, you'll want to get any door codes for the bathroom and or the conference room if there's any so you can let yourself in and out and try to keep your out-of-office time to a minimum because at any moment the mediator may return. And if you're out, you know, in the lobby or making a phone call or out there or something and the mediator can't get a hold of you, it could be disruptive to the flow of the mediation. You want to make sure you get any Wi-Fi access information up front so you have the ability to connect to the internet if you need to. And you'll want to have some type of office contact so that if you need something while the mediator is busy with the other party, you have someone to help you or somewhere to go to get information or get some assistance with something. You'll also want to confirm the arrival and departure procedures and times for both parties. This can be really helpful in avoiding escalations in the parking lot or in the lobby. And usually what I do is try to stagger start times, you know, about 15 minutes apart. So someone will get there 15 minutes early and get them in the room and then get them situated. And then I go greet the other party and put them in the other room so they don't bump into each other, especially at the start or, you know, that can be disruptive to the initial starting tone of everything. And then we also want to avoid it at the end. So I'll release a party, you know, 15 minutes early, give them a chance to get out and get to their car and get gone before I release the second party. And so that is those procedures are going to be helpful for you both to know what they are. So you know when to show up and how to avoid the other party. Some things to bring to your mediation, having snacks and water or coffee or tea is good. Try to avoid drinking too much. We have to run to the bathroom a lot if possible. You want to bring court paperwork if there is any references to things that should have been shared up front with the mediator, but just have copies of things there. Maybe in case there's income questions, you know, having your tax returns or other important financial documents or other documents handy in case they're needed would be a wise move. That way the mediation can easily access them and keep moving forward productively without having to take a break while you look up the information. You're going to want to bring notebook, pens, pencils, so you can take notes as you go. Usually the mediator can provide these things, but I wouldn't rely on it. Sometimes they won't have an adequate notebook. Sometimes they'll have notepads, and it's not sufficient for, you know, taking good notes and mapping out ideas. So it's a good idea to bring your own situation that you're comfortable with and that works for you. If you want to bring a tablet or a laptop, if that's needed, do that. Do bring, however, earbuds or headphones. So if you're doing anything like watching or listening to your device, it doesn't make noise. As usually there's other activities going on in adjacent offices or conference rooms that could be disruptive. And you can also bring any distractionary activities or reading materials so that if the mediator's gone for a while, you have something to distract or occupy your mind. But just keep it positive, you know, maybe something lighthearted to help you distract you from things and keep things moving in a good direction for you there. So you can take a mental break and be ready. Things not to bring to your shuttle mediation. First, your children. I can't tell you how many times, you know, we bring this up. People show up with their young children and they say, sorry, I couldn't find anywhere else to put them. And it's like, well, where are we going to put them? Because we can't put them in the room while you're talking about things that might be inappropriate. So they can't run around the lobby or the office unsupervised. That may not be okay. And so make arrangements. If you can't, coordinate with your mediator up front so that there's no issues with you bringing your children, because at that point you're kind of stuck. You're either going to have to leave the mediation and And usually most mediators have a cancellation clause, so you might still have to pay for the entire mediation session, even though you're not going to have it now. So you want to really take this seriously and think about these logistics before you get in there. Other things not to bring, your family members, significant others, unless it's cleared by the mediator. So the mediation is between the two parties, and it has, you know, no direct concern with third parties, even though you may be remarried and they're part of your life. They're not a third party to you. To the mediation, they are. Again, we have confidentiality to manage, things like that. And also, we want to try to avoid, the mediator wishes to avoid, at least I do, having third parties having a strong voice or presence in the negotiation, because it's, again, it's really up to the authorized participants who are supposed to be there. If you do have an interest in bringing someone, then clear it with the mediator and confirm that it's okay that they come but sit in the lobby. Even that can be an issue if both parties bring supportive, people with them, because then those supportive people now can be in the lobby or the waiting room, and you know that can escalate. So we really try to avoid doing that and just clear all that with the mediator before you come in. The other thing I would say is avoid bringing any complete meals or have DoorDashed or delivery of complete meals. That's also can be very distracting and inappropriate in some cases. Those kind of things. Lunch should be coordinated with the mediator. Again, bring snacks all you want. It's really important to keep the blood sugar up and not get frustrated and tired and irritable because you're, you know, hungry and getting, you know, irritated by that. But we want to avoid bringing in, you know, really, you know, aromatic, large meals that take over the conference table or things like that. So that's something you should coordinate with your mediator. One of the biggest aspects, as I mentioned, is the waiting in between mediator visits with you. So try to make this time productive. Sometimes it could be 10 minutes. Sometimes it can be a minute, you know, when they just go ask a question and come back. Sometimes it can be an hour. So again, the mediator is trying to make the best call all the time about where to spend their time and how to keep the pace going and keep enough back and forth going to make it valuable. But sometimes we honestly get stuck with the other party and we need to explain things or work through some emotions so we can get back to a productive thing, or we have a momentum going that we really want to capitalize on before we come back. Because if we just come back and say, sorry, we were getting somewhere, but I know I left you alone, so I'm coming back empty-handed, but just so that you see me, I'm showing up. You know, people can get irritated with that. It's like, I wish you just stayed and got the info. So keep yourself productive when you are left alone in the room or on the video conference. So if the mediator doesn't give you anything or assign you something to do during their time away, ask, is there something I should be doing? This is, a lot of people take this as a break, like I've stated my offer, go deliver that offer and let me know how it goes. And then they sit around and don't do anything productive. And this is time that you should be spending productively. You're working. The mediator's working over there. You should be working too. And so if you don't know what to work on, ask the mediator and they should give you something. And you might be told you could start brainstorming some solutions. You can start to really evaluate your goals better. Look at our episode on the outside in goal setting approach, where if you come in with what we call an outside goal, which is a goal tied to a physical thing, like, I want 50-50 parenting time or I'm, you know, going to escalate this with the court or something like that. That's an outside goal. It's your success in mediation is tied to some external thing. If your goal is shifted, however, to, I want as much access as I can have to be present as a parent with my child or children, then that becomes a different goal. That could be satisfied in a number of ways and not just a hard 50-50 number. And so that might mean things like maybe you could be more active after school without having the overnight, for example. Like if it's, again, we have to think about transitions and exchanges and stuff, but all things being good, there may be some productive things that might be available to us that don't translate into hard overnights, for example. So thinking about what your actual goal is and trying to move it to an inside goal, which is tied to a value and not an external limited quantity thing, like number of overnights or something like that. That could be a productive use of time. So it offers up flexibility in your negotiations with each other so that there's many ways to solve inside goals, but only one way to solve an outside goal. So that could be an incredibly good use of your time. You should always consider your options while the mediator is away and continually reevaluate your other options. And that might include your best alternative to a negotiated agreement, your BATNA, your worst alternative to a negotiated agreement, your WATNA, or the zone of possible agreement, ZOPA. And these are some pretty rudimentary negotiation terms, and we have a whole episode on that, so you can look at that. But you should always be reevaluating your options, so that's a productive use of time. This is a time you can also get feedback from your attorney or other advisors, if you have them. You can call them if they're not present with you, and use that time to bounce ideas back and forth, or you know, see what advice they might have. During this time, you can also just think about what's at stake. You know, what is it you're trying to achieve or avoid, I guess, either way. But keep in mind what's really at stake here. Your children, access to your children, that type of thing, or your level of conflict, your mental health, etc. So think about what's really at stake in terms of, you know, if you want to dig in and get a certain level of overnights, or you're going to throw it to the court. You know, that might put one of your primary goals, which is having access, more access with your children, in jeopardy, because the court may decide to do something completely different with the overnights, and you lose track of what's at stake, and you end up getting hung up on overnight counts or, you know, some positional commitment you've made to yourself or your attorney or even the other party, and you're choosing to be inflexible. If that costs you something, think about that. Is it worth it? And so always keep in mind what's at stake. Many times people say my mental health is more important than this thing we're arguing about. So I'm willing to concede that so I can move forward and be productive and put my energy into that. That's not a bad outcome or a bad option, right? If your mental health and your level of conflict outside of mediation has value to you, then it can offset any concessions you make in the mediation. So think about those things as well, so that you prioritize, you know, what's at stake. You can, if there's anything about the mediation that's, you know, the interaction with the mediator that's got you agitated or activated, you know, with anxiety or anger, you can practice some calming activities. Focus on breathing is always a good one. You can bring distractionary activities, like you can journal. I've seen people bring coloring books, novels, read jokes or something uplifting to try to redirect you from your emotional right side, you know, brain, and move you into your left side, more logical side. And usually the right side reacts really quick and the left side catches up. So sometimes you just need a distractionary activity to kind of build in a delay. And then suddenly things seem better as your left side kicks in and starts to bring some order to the chaos of the emotional right side. So sometimes those activities can be helpful in buying yourself time. Okay, so one of the other things is having to understand up front and make sure you think about all the way through is any confidentiality concerns. Mediators have different assumptive guidelines around what is confidential. Some say, unless you flag it as confidential, I'm going to share whatever I think I need to get movement on the other party. Others say, everything discussed in here is confidential, and if I need to use something, I'm going to ask permission. So you want to clarify. You don't want to assume that let's say you've been through mediation 10 times before, and every time that mediator has said everything in here is strictly confidential. And now you're on your 11th mediator, and that mediator operates differently and starts sharing information because they operate differently. And so you're going to want to not assume and clarify, especially if there's anything confidential that you want to make sure isn't shared with the other party. And sometimes this can be things as simple as if there's safety concerns, while we have to work through sharing of financial information with each other, so we have a disclosure so people see, you know, how we're generating the child support, for example. If the mediator knows that there are safety concerns, then they may, they can share the income information without showing the pay stub, which has your address or your employer on it, information you may not want the other party to know if there's any safety concerns, for example. So these kind of things are important to think about. So the mediator is also in sync with you about what is going to be shared and what is not going to be shared. Okay, so next, when is shuttle mediation used? So here are a couple of things. When there is going to be no joint sessions at all, then we have shuttle mediation. So if we're having some joint sessions, but we're also having some one-on-one sessions with a mediator, but we're going to at any point get together into a joint session, we don't have shuttle mediation. We have private caucuses. So one-on-one meetings with a mediator that make end in coming together, or work with joint meetings and in one-on-one meetings together, all that then is private caucuses. If you're never going to get together, we have what's called shuttle mediation. And they are different, although the behaviors and process might seem similar and there might be a lot of overlap. Shuttle is definitely in place when there's no joint sessions at all. Shuttle will be used when the mediator or the attorney will identify you as a high conflict couple or a high conflict discussion. So that may be when we resort to shuttle. When there's any safety concerns between the parties, shuttle may be necessary or appropriate for the situation. If there's any restraining orders or no contact orders by the court, then shuttle is going to be used. Also, when either party just requests it and the mediator deems it appropriate, then we'll use shuttle. So that might be necessary sometimes if there's not a safety issue or a court order to not occupy the same space or have contact, but maybe it's more of I get intimidated when I'm with the other party and I tend to defer or shut down. Well, maybe we should use shuttle then so that that doesn't happen. And so those are some good times when to utilize shuttle mediation. Some special considerations with shuttle mediation, restraining orders. So parties who have restraining orders that either say they can't be within a certain proximity of each other or that they may have no contact with each other, and that really means no contact. Running into each other in a mediator Zoom call or, a video conference call could violate that restraining order. And then that could create some real problems. And so you really want to, when there's a restraining order in place and you're going to mediation, work with the mediator on confirming that you have the appropriate authority and authorization from the court to conduct the mediation. What this looks like is, even though the court may order you to mediation, and this gets a little sticky, but the court says the parties must attend mediation and the court knows you have a restraining order, you still should confirm that you have what's called special permission from the court, or that it's written down that the parties have an exception to their restraining order to participate in the mediation. And typically courts will be proactive and say that the parties may communicate via the mediator or directly as a function of the mediation if the mediator deems it appropriate. And they may put that in the order to mediate, right? But they don't do it all the time. And I don't know, maybe someone else can explain this to me and to you. But if the court knows that there's a restraining order in place, they've ordered you to mediation, I have sadly got real experience with a party showing up at a mediation, and then the other party communicates to the court that party violated the restraining order because they showed up at the same office. And the court agreed with them. And it's like, well, how did you think we were going to do this mediation? So unfortunately, it may seem like a pain, but I would confirm with the court in writing that you have special permission. So contact your family court facilitator and make sure that you get some kind of statement that says the court authorizes you to, for the purposes of the mediation, to be in physical proximity of each other or be able to communicate or contact either directly or only through the mediator. But make sure that that's all covered, because if the mediator thinks it's productive for you to be in person, let's say, and then you run into each other in the parking lot, that's going to be a problem. And so we want to make sure you get special permission from the court. You also want to make sure with restraining orders that we have staggered arrival, join, or departure times. I will typically set this up in advance, but we want to make sure that this is done. And how it's done is also important. So usually in the restraining order, there's a person who the restraining order is identified as the person who needs to stay away. Maybe they were part of some domestic violence investigation or activity. And so I'll usually have either, it just depends on the situation, but I'll have usually one of them show up early. Maybe I'll have the person who, you know, is more of the one who's got the safety concern show up first, make sure they're secured in the office, and then have the other person show up late, a little bit later. And I'll give them on purpose. I won't say, well, I'm staggering your start times. I'll just say, here's when I want you here. And to the greater the degree of the safety issue, I'll widen that time. Sometimes I'll even make it a half an hour because, unfortunately, people who are savvy to this will show up 15 minutes early just as an opportunity to get access to the person in the parking lot or make sure they're seen so they can have an intimidating look or something like that. So we will have to address that and make sure that you address those staggered arrival and departure times. And then typically if at the end I'll have the person who's more on the, you know, more concerned about the safety leave first, and I'll hang on to the person who's, you know, more of the one that we're concerned about. And that way I can keep an eye on them while the other person gets to their car and gets out, that type of thing. So we want to make sure we think about those things too, to make sure that the restraining order is not violated, you know, at the street corner after the mediation. And you do want to confirm the court specific authorizations with the mediator before arriving at the mediation. So it's not enough for you to say, I think I understand it. You have to make sure the mediator understands it as well, and that everybody's on the same page, so that we know what we're doing, what we're all authorized to do. So there's no unintentional, you know, opportunities for people to violate, which don't really make a difference in terms of someone violating. If it's an accident or not, it's still a violation. So you really need to take care of that. Another special circumstance with shuttles is you can have attorneys in shuttle mediation, and they can take on, you know, it's very flexible in how they participate. They may be there in case you have questions. They may be, if you're in person, they may be in the room with you, and you do primarily most of the speaking with the mediator, if that's appropriate. They may speak on your behalf if there's an issue advocating, or if there are, you know, concerns about you talking directly with the mediator. And you both determine it's better if the attorney addresses that on your behalf, then the mediator will speak directly with the attorney, and you can confirm or, you know, agree or participate that way. You may be there in the mediation alone, but the attorney makes themselves available back at the office, let's say, and you can contact them on times when the mediator's with the other party to say, here's where the conversation's going, here's what they're proposing, what do you think? And, you know, they can apprise you of some legal feedback on what's being discussed. We do want to be careful with some of this in that from your perspective as the participant, we want to make sure that we are coming up with agreements through the mediation, and that the attorneys are supposed to help you with, here's the considerations of what you're doing, without actually trying to guide or manipulate the negotiation as their role in your legal advisor. That's more behavior that you're going to rely on if the mediation doesn't work and you're going to go into a, you know, litigation style. Then obviously the lawyer will make directions and try to influence things directly through the work they do there. But in the mediation, we're trying to get to constructive and creative agreements between you and the other party. And this is, you know, hopefully the attorneys are taking the role of, well, here's what you need to be thinking about if you consider that offer, instead of, you know, getting feedback, oh, that's ridiculous, we can do much better than that, here's what I think you should do. And participating in the negotiation that way, that's not really you know, usually that's not something that is consistent with what we're trying to do in mediation, as we're an alternative to, you know, litigation. So be aware of that. You may be in the office and your attorney joins by in virtual. So they may be there participating in on the computer virtually while you're in person, or you both may be at the attorney's office, both participating virtually, that type of thing. So all these different combinations are ways that the attorney can participate with you logistically and procedurally in a shuttle mediation. Safety is another special consideration for shuttle mediation. So make sure that the mediator is aware if there is any safety concern, such as if there is any previous domestic or physical abuse, even if it hasn't occurred recently. If it's ever out there, make sure the mediator knows that. If there is any concern about public safety, even if there hasn't been any previous activity or domestic or abuse, or physical or domestic abuse, make sure that if there's concern about that possibility, even if it hasn't occurred before, the mediator knows about it. If you have any fear about retribution following the mediation, these kinds of situations are not acceptable. And in order, there's things we can do to help protect against them. And if these types of things, depending on the level of the retribution, if it's going to be a physical retribution or harassment or something like that, then in order to keep the people safe, the mediator may suggest or even require that the negotiations only go through your attorneys together in shuttle, so that the attorneys are advising each of you about the offer and therefore can advise their client about, you know, what the acceptable behaviors are, what, you know, how to keep things safe, right? By having the attorneys involved, it really discourages someone from getting aggressive in a mediation, either with the mediator in an attempt to intimidate or, you know, manipulate the mediator or the other party, because it's much harder to do if you have to tell your attorney, say this in an intimidating way and thinly veil retribution. You know, the attorney's not going to do that. So it's a way to diffuse quite effectively those types of situations. And now if there is any retribution, the attorneys have both heard what's going on, and that usually will discourage a party too, because now the more people that know about that party's dissatisfaction with, you know, the way things are going, and there's any retribution, there's now people involved, and that can be very useful in discouraging them to follow through with their, you know, come at you after the mediation. So lastly, if there's any concern about the safety for the children, make sure the mediator knows about it, whether it is through, you know, the safety is, again, any abuse or problems that have happened in the past, mediator needs to know about it. Even if there was nothing going on between you and the other party, but it was with the children, obviously, we need to know about that. And we need to understand that so that we're aware and conscious of how we're discussing, let's say, parenting time changes or things like that, so that we are not inadvertently, you know, negatively affecting the requirement of safety for the children and can help keep that represented through the process. One last special consideration is what's called a mediator proposal. So as we get down to the end of the mediation, let's say neither party is agreeable, their offers aren't being received, and we're kind of stuck. If both parties agree, the mediator can make what's called a mediator proposal. It is a last ditch, take it or leave it offer based on what the mediator knows both parties have within their capability to do, and what we've been discussing. They find that offer that they think could be a fair outcome for both parties, and they will put that together into a mediator proposal and say, here's the offer. This is the overnight count you'll get. This is the child support amount. This is how we'll resolve these issues. That's it. It's take it or leave it. There's no more time. There's no more discussion. And so if both parties agree, then the mediator can write that up and that'll be your agreement. If both parties don't agree, then there's nothing lost. So you're free to pursue, you know, other mediations or utilize court process or consult with your attorney if you have one to think about other ways to move forward from there. The mediator proposal, when it's presented to you, you will not know if the other party has agreed to it or not, as a, you know, until you both agree. So if you say, no, I refuse to do that, did they agree to this? I'm not going to tell you, because that way you're still free. It doesn't divulge any negotiation position tolerances inadvertently. So if the other party doesn't agree or does agree, I'm not going to tell you. You have to decide if you agree or not. And if you agree and they agreed, I say you both agree. If you agree and the other party doesn't, then, you know, the other party didn't agree, and that's okay. It's that situation where the other party agrees, and then I tell you, do you agree? I'm not going to tell you if they agreed first or not before you agree. So that way it doesn't divulge the other person's position in order for you to, you know, to capitalize on. So that's the confidentiality part of that. And if we, if that's useful, we can do that. If not, then, you know, the mediator can sign the certificate of mediation that says the parties came in and gave a good faith effort, but we didn't get anywhere. And then you can take that to the court as verification that you did complete the required mediation. So I know it's a lot of information, but I wanted to cover all that so that you knew the kinds of things to consider, the kinds of things to talk about with your mediator, to discuss for their specific practice, their approach, what in your case, what are the things to, you know, explore where that might affect how you operate or work through the, you know, within your specific case. So the case we mentioned at the top of this episode certainly was not positioned well for success when it came to me, but by utilizing all these various different aspects of the shuttle mediation, we were able to explore some options and arrived at a mutually agreeable solution within the time frame, and we got it done. And it's wild sometimes how being on a time crunch and having restrictions can focus your attention on what is agreeable, and that happened in this case. So the benefits of the mediation, the control, the cost savings, the avoidance of other, you know, worse alternatives, all were accessed by these parties, even though real communication and interaction between them was not even a possibility. We still got the benefits of the mediation when that was the case. So that's how powerful shuttle can be. Okay, in our next episode, we are going to discuss the different outcomes of mediation, as it is actually more than just either successful or unsuccessful outcomes. We will explore how not coming up with an agreement may not be considered a failure, and what it looks like when reaching an agreement may not actually be considered a success. So we'll explore all that in our next episode, and I think you'll find that valuable to understand. This has been Tom Davis. Thank you for joining me today. Remember to protect every accomplishment you make together, and that setbacks are just wins in the making. Stay positive. The Pro Se Divorce Podcast is a production of Family Synergy Mediation. The information in these podcasts are opinions only and should not be considered legal advice. Visit myfamilymediation.com to learn more.